You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week I have Jimmy.
Hello.
And I have Greg.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about season 14 of Doctor Who, which is very easily, arguably, one of the best, I think it's fair to say. It's a really strong run. We talked about how strong a run season 13 was when we discussed that, and we've kind of moved on now to one that's probably even better, I'd say. So, as always, we will start by quickly discussing what our favourite episodes from the run are, favourite stories from the run are. So, Jimmy, you go first. What's your favourite from season 14?
It's a tough choice because the season is so good that all of the stories are honestly quite a good contender, but I think I would have to give the edge to The Robots of Death personally.
And it's a cracking story. Can't argue with that at all. What about you, Greg?
I have exactly the same answer. It's a really tough choice, but I have to go with The Robots of Death. I think it's just an absolutely superlative Doctor Who story.
I am going to go for something slightly different. I'm going to go for The Deadly Assassin, which, if I had to pick, I'd say is probably my favourite ever of all time, certainly on TV. I just don't think Doctor Who's ever got better than that. However, Robots of Death is pretty close. It's very, very excellent. It's a fantastic story, fantastic world building, fantastic set of characters. And it is just Tom at his absolute peak. He's amazing from start to finish, but I think it's fair to say that of the whole season, to be perfectly honest. Well, we will, as tradition dictates, start at the start. The first story of this season is The Mask of Mandragora, which is, it's an interesting little one because it's not something I think that could have fit into the season before. We did have some sort of gothic-y, horror-y type stuff previously, but I think this story has its own identity. It's very, very different to the previous two seasons kind of stuff, and I quite like that we get that. It's a returning writer, but a writer that hasn't written a lot before, Louis Marks. He did was it Planet of Giants and Day of the Daleks, I think. So, you know, two very different stories there, actually. You know, your mileage on how much you like both of those, and indeed this one may vary, but I think that this is probably the only time in the Hinchcliffe era that they've gone back to a 60s writer, and it's been pretty successful. So we'll sort of go from there. So Mask of Mandragora, Jimmy, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I hadn't actually thought about that. I hadn't really noticed. I don't usually pay that much attention to who wrote what, but seeing that it's a returning writer is a surprise, and he's definitely improved a lot since his previous two stories. I really enjoy The Mask of Mandragora. It's got such a great setting and such a great atmosphere, and it's just Sarah and Tom Baker at their peak. They've got such a great dynamic, and this story really utilises both of them well, and I love the historical period that they're sort of going for. And another thing I really like is the secondary control room. It just looks so amazing. It's such a good idea, and just turning it all wooden and gothic and fitting for that sort of story. It's a shame they didn't keep it after this season, because it's probably one of my favourite designs of the classic series. There's not really much more I can say about the story. I like the whole astrology and the helix being, you know, a villain themed on that, and the way they leave the room at the end for a sequel, and they've done different things with the books and the audios, and even apparently the astrology sort of themed space villain from the Sarah Jane Adventures was originally going to be the Mandragora, and I think it's a pity it wasn't, because it would have been just interesting to see a follow-up to that story after so long.
And it's kind of implied that the Mandragora will come back around the end of the 20th, start of the 21st century. So actually sticking it in Sarah Jane Adventures would have worked brilliantly. I guess they were kind of lining up a potential Mandragora modern day, perhaps Unity sequel that obviously never materialised because that's not where the series was going. Should also mention Louis Marks also wrote Planet of Evil in the previous season. I did forget to mention that before. Greg, what about you? Mask of Mandragora.
Well, it's better than Planet of Evil, I can tell you that.
Yes.
It's actually very good. It's one of the best looking classic Doctor Who stories, just straight up. Like the costume design is phenomenal. Like the filming locations are believable. The sets look gorgeous. Like it is an absolutely beautiful story. And apart from, you know, the actual Mandragora helix just being, you know, superimposed on the screen, like it's completely believable what you see. And even there, it's just a ball of energy. So who's to say it doesn't look like that? But that's probably my favorite thing about it. I also really like how the helix itself is not that scientifically explained of a villain. Like Russell Davis has expressed that, you know, Doctor Who as it is right now going forward is going to be a bit more, you know, fantasy rather than pure sci-fi oriented. And I think Mask of Mandragora is a rare example from the classic series of tipping, you know, completely over into fantasy, because I mean, there's basically no effort at scientific explanations offered here. I mean, yeah, they go into astrology quite a bit, but the whole time the Doctor's just rolling his eyes at it, so you're not really supposed to take that seriously. And yeah, I mean, it's just this malevolent ball of energy from beyond time that's, you know, come to Earth and or beyond space or whatever you want to call it. It's hard to explain. It's, you know, it doesn't really get a concrete explanation. And I like that. I like, you know, having that every once in a while. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, the performances are good. You know, Tom Baker, like you said, is really on top form this entire season. And it starts here. I'm trying to think if I have anything else really to say about it. I mean, I don't, you know, the actual story itself isn't that exciting, I guess. I think this is probably the weakest story of the season, but if this is the weakest story of the season, then you've got yourself a great season, because there's a lot to like here.
I think that's a fair point. You probably could argue that it's the weakest from the season, and it's good. It's very, very good. You were mentioning how great it looked like Port Merryn, the filming location. I've sort of spent a lot of time there. It's a genuinely beautiful place. It's also where they filmed the original Prisoner series, and it's just incredible. It's kind of surreal. It is literally an attempt to build an Italian village in North Wales. It shouldn't work, but it does, and it really is worth a visit. If at all possible, which I get is far easier for me than you guys. It's 2.5 hours up the road for me. But yeah, I've stayed in the hotel there and everything. It is such a wonderful place. It really, really is. And they couldn't have picked anywhere better without actually going to Italy, which they weren't going to do in 1976. But yeah, excellent story, a lot to like. And like you say, the Mandragora is an interesting villain. I'm kind of surprised that Big Finish haven't got the claws into it. As far as I'm aware, they've never touched it. And it does seem to be relatively ripe for a return. No doubt I'm going to get tweeted at now.
They did imply that at the end of their Sarah Jane series that it was in the final story of that. I haven't quite listened to it in a long time. I remember the first series of that very well, but don't remember the second so well. But I think it was, implied.
That rings a bell, actually. Yes, I've listened to it relatively recently, last couple of years. But yeah, I think I probably need to return to that and see. But it's definitely a villain you can do something with, I think. Definitely something there's room for. We'll move on. And we're going to move on to another great story, and another story that I really don't think you could have fit into the last 2 years. It's The Hand of Evil, which is, I mean, I think it's quite unique. I don't think there are many 70s Doctor Who stories like this. It's the Fourth Doctor and Sarah on Earth for the most part. And yes, okay, you know, we do have stories like that. We have Robot, we have Android Invasion. I think Android Invasion is probably the nearest thing you can compare it to. But I do think it's a very, very unique and different story with a very unique and different villain, actually. A bit of a rough one for Sarah. She does get properly put through the ringer in this, and no wonder she's not too hesitant about leaving at the end. And we'll talk a little bit more about Sarah in the end afterwards. But overall, what are your thoughts on The Hand of Fear? Jimmy, you go first.
I think it's definitely, it's got a really high reputation due to Sarah's departure, but I think it's not quite as great as some people would say. I do enjoy it. I enjoy all of this season, but I think it just, it was a very long and slow start and took a while to get into it, but once picked up, it was a lot better. Sarah's costume is just ridiculous, but I think that sort of works because it's, you know, they're trying to show that she's, you know, alienated and changed and not really fitting in with the present day, but it does look not great. I love the whole dynamic of the alien Eldrad being, you know, trying to get back to the planet, trying to get revenge, and then, oh, whoops, it's been however many million years and no one else is even left alive. It's just, that's a really good surprise ending to have. And I think the thing with it is also Eldrad, I think the thing is that when he changes into the male actor instead of the actress, the acting goes a lot hammier and over the top, and I think the story would have really worked better if they'd just kept the female Eldrad and had her sort of go a bit more dark and angry and, you know, but not to that extent. But I think it doesn't really work when he turns back into the guy. Also, even though it's only four parts, it does feel a little bit padded in places. I think it works well despite that, and Liz is wonderful when she's playing the possessed Sarah. It's just wonderfully creepy, and it's a great story, and it's sad to see her go, but that final farewell scene between her and the Doctor is just brilliantly played by both of them, and her not really wanting to go but pretending she does, and then the Doctor being like, oh yeah, you do have to go, and just the shock value. And I love that scene, and it makes a great end to their dynamic together. And it's a great way to finish off their era and to see what's coming next.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that we have this little hangover of Sarah for these two stories. It's almost like an epilogue to the last few years, really. This season doesn't really develop its own identity until it moves forward. Although, as I've said, the two stories that we do get are quite different from anything that we got last year. So it is a little curio that we have these sort of two final Sarah Jane stories that they do feel somewhat disconnected to everything else. But they're both excellent stories. Greg, go ahead.
There's things to like here for sure. And there are things to dislike. I think the great amount of location filming, again, in this story works to its benefit. A lot of the nuclear power plant, for example, is filmed in an actual power plant, and it's not all just like obvious BBC sets. And then it's nice to have the characters land in a quarry, and it's actually a quarry. That's always a fun little twist. The quarry explosion looks fantastic. I don't know if that was stock footage or what, but that's interesting. It's a Bob Baker, Dave Martin story. So we had a little bit of a break from their usual output with the Centauran experiment, but here we're back to doing something that the show just does not even remotely have the capability to execute, and that's with a disembodied hand crawling around. When it's just like the close-up of the hand in the box, it looks good, but outside of that, it really just doesn't look convincing at all. Having to, have it like possess Sarah and have her walking around, like, I don't think that Elizabeth Sladen's performance is bad per se, but I feel like they're trying to go for it being really scary, and it doesn't feel scary at all. So that is a little odd to me. But and the interesting thing about it too is like episode two, I think especially, is padded out. Like there's a lot of just running from point A to point B. But by the time you get to episode four, the actual ending of it is really interesting for classic Doctor Who. I mean, to find out that everyone on the planet is dead and gone and has been for thousands or millions or whatever years, and the final message of Hail Eldred, King of Nothing, like that's excellent. That's the kind of ending you rarely get, like in anything really. It's really smart and really inventive. And then unfortunately we still have the raving monster that needs to be taken care of. So then it trips over a scarf and falls in a hole. It's like, oh, okay, well, I guess we had to end this somehow. But conceptually, it's really good. This and Mandragora are like the contenders for the weakest story of the season. I think this one like gets to higher highs than its predecessor, but I think the lows are a bit lower too. But I still enjoyed it though.
I think that, as Jimmy rightly said, this one kind of does get bumped up a little bit in people's estimations purely because of how it ends. There is a very, very, very nice, very well done departure scene, because Sarah Jane did have to leave in this one, and the action does stop 10 minutes early so we can say a proper goodbye, which is still pretty rare. We kind of got it with Victoria, we got it with Joe, but a proper send off, I suppose we got it for Ian and Barbara in The Chase as well, but we've come a long way from some of the really dodgy mid to late 60s companion departures, sending Dodo off halfway through a story and Polly and Ben popping back just for one scene to say goodbye. We've certainly moved on a long way from that, and I'm glad that Sarah gets a proper send off, and I think that probably sort of contributes to how beloved she is as a character and as a companion. We got to say goodbye to her, and then years later we got to say hello to her again. So let's just pause our viewing of season 14 to discuss that departure scene, to discuss Sarah Jane, and it's a beautiful little scene, I think. So Jimmy, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think it's great that they got to sort of work on that scene themselves, and that it was, not just from the writers, it was from them as actors, and really them saying goodbye to, well, not Tom saying goodbye to his character because he obviously continued, but Liz getting the chance to say goodbye to Sarah. And of course, we know now she eventually came back for the Five Doctors. They tried to do Canine Company, and then we finally got the new series and the Sarah Jane Adventures. And it's just so brilliant that the character has lasted so long and came back after so long and had that revival. But yeah, I love her original tenure too. I'm one of those rare people who I think she worked better as a character with Pertwee, even though obviously as an actress there was more chemistry with Tom, but I think the character was slightly better written in the Pertwee era. But yeah, even despite that, I still loved her performance in the Tom era, and yeah, I think she had a really strong, well-written exit there. And yeah, I love the character, but I'm glad she did get that chance to come back, because I enjoy the new series portrayal of her and the Sarah Jane Adventures portrayal of her too. And so, yeah, definitely a great character.
Yeah, absolutely. And Greg, what about you?
So I agree with Jimmy that I think Sarah works better in the Pertwee era, but I think it's more that Sarah just works better on Earth, because her background, you know, as an investigative journalist, like, is very relevant and very useful on Earth, especially on modern day Earth, which is where, you know, the Pertwee era spends a good chunk of its time. And, you know, early on in Tom Baker's era, we keep coming back to it too. Whereas once, you know, when they're off in space, you know, she's, as written, she's more of a generic companion. And honestly, I think it's interesting because you can argue that she's the last of the, like, very traditional companion style characters. I mean, maybe you can say, you know, Perry ends up similar. What I'm talking about is, you know, like a character who's often reduced to just kind of following the Doctor around and asking questions and doesn't really have a lot like distinguishing them. And I think when they're off in space, like the character doesn't get distinguished. But the reason why she's so, you know, memorable to me is because of the performance. I mean, Liz Sladen was fantastic. And, you know, I talked a little bit about this, you know, in previous seasons, but she had this ability to take, you know, these, you know, generic like companion moments and like put little, you know, twists on them and play with it a little bit, and, you know, constantly just making this character like someone you want to watch, someone you want to see what she's going to do next. Like, she's incredibly appealing and open as a performer. Like, there's a warmth to it that really works. And, you know, the ending scene in Hand of Fear is wonderful. I mean, if the whole story had led up to that, in terms of just an actual leaving scene, it might be the best departure individual scene. It's that or the Green Death. But the difference is, what story-wise, is that the Green Death is like thematically and like plot-wise, like very deliberately leads up to that. Whereas here, it just comes out of nowhere. I mean, it has absolutely nothing to do with what's happened for the, you know, the previous 90 minutes of broadcast TV. So, you know, in that sense, it's not as good, but I mean, the actual scene itself is just wonderful. And I mean, you can see how, you know, heartbroken the two actors are to be, you know, parted from each other because of how close they were. And yeah, it's hard to watch, but it's really good. And I think it's probably the last good companion departure of the classic series, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that's unreasonable, actually. I think some companions get good final scenes, but I don't think they get a genuinely good departure. I don't think they get a genuinely good sort of real goodbye. Like, I like the way Turlo goes. I kind of wish Planet of Fire had made more of it. You know, the story is very much linked to him leaving. He leaves for a reason. Tegan gets a great goodbye scene, but again, it's literally just, I'm off now, Doctor, bye.
Yeah, and it's so quick too. That's the thing. Like, Turlo's probably the competitor, like, going forward is the...
Yeah, but I think that's because Planet of Fire is such a brilliantly written story, and it's by the writer that introduced him and had an idea of where the character was going to go, presumably when he started. And I think that definitely sort of gives Turlo a bit of an advantage. Everything else is a bit rushed, a bit made up on the spot, a bit shot by King Yukarnos, controlled by the Time Lords. It's definitely fair to argue that this is perhaps the last proper goodbye. I suppose Adric got a good departure, but not quite the same. Let's move on to the Deadly Assassin. And as I said at the start, this is as good as Doctor Who has ever got on TV for me. I genuinely think that this is an absolutely flawless masterpiece. I know it's not to everybody's taste. I know that it certainly wasn't well received at the time, but I really think it does some really interesting stuff. and still has time to do some excellent things on location. It's got some brilliant location filming, you know, a running theme already for this season. I love the stuff about the Matrix. It blows Doctor Who wide open. It takes what we got in the War Games and, you know, hinted at in the Three Doctors, and it doesn't just build on it a little bit. It sticks a skyscraper on there, and it's fantastic. It really does feel like a turning point in Doctor Who, and it's set up some really wonderful stuff. Big Finish, you know, the Gallifrey series would not exist without the Deadly Assassin. We get an amazing incarnation of the Master. What a way to put a twist on that character. And I know it's not Roger Delgado, and we all love Roger Delgado, but what a departure from that, and what a way of still doing it so brilliantly. So that's me rambling about it enough. Let's go to Jimmy. What do you think of the Deadly Assassin?
I think for me, I mean, I do enjoy it. I do like the story, but for me, it's of this season, it's the bottom of the stories. It's great, but it's also overrated. I do like that they brought the Master back, but the thing for me that I've gotten so used to from the audio is the decayed Master being the Jeffrey Beavers version, and hearing Pratt in the role, he's just not as good as Beavers, and I really, because the audio version has had so much longer to establish that incarnation with a different actor, it just feels a bit weird and wrong having this different actor who's not quite as good. But it is interesting to see the Master return. I'll definitely give them that. And it's a shame that it was only for this and the Keeper of Triarchon that we got this incarnation on TV. Other things about this story, I would say the thing is that since it was setting up this new era of the Time Lords and setting up things being different, some of the stuff that I noticed is just the stuff that doesn't quite fit with what comes later or what comes earlier. Like, I think they could have made more of Goth being, you know, it's the same actor who was one of the Time Lords who put the second Doctor on trial, and they sort of didn't really do anything with that. Like, I mean, I think it was not really even implied so much until the extended universe got its hands on it, but that they could have done possibly more with that. And then the other inconsistencies are things like the seal of Rassilon being called the Prydonian seal, the news presenter covering the Time Lord president mentioning that the robes are seldom worn, and then every Time Lord story for the rest of all time, it's just that's all they ever wear. And speaking of the robes, the Time Lord shaped chalk outline, I'm not sure whether it was intended to be funny or not, but it definitely was hard to take seriously. And the other thing was, I know a lot of the extended universe is focused on the Time Lords being all about technology and the sisterhood from Khan being all about magic, but there's this line in this story where I forget which character it was. It might have been Spandrel, it might have been Engen, but they say something about the barren road of technology as if the Time Lords are using magic or something. It's just strange. Like, if it's not technology, what is it? The other thing for me that really didn't work for the story was, I know you said about the location filming being great, but for me, that whole Matrix sequence, I mean, I love the concept of the Matrix and of all the Time Lord minds, dead Time Lord minds being there. I think it's a great concept, but I think it was poorly used in the story. The entire scenes in the Matrix, the Doctor running and hiding and facing off, it was all just a load of padding and not much anything good in the way of writing. It was just long, pointless and dragged out for me. It really sort of detracts from the story. I mean, they could have had a whole episode more of stuff on Gallifrey, essentially, but they just did this load of padding. I really didn't like that part of the story at all. And then at the end, there's also the Master's face showing up on the grandfather clock before they disappear. Like, it's supposed to be just a TARDIS. I mean, it's, why is his face popping out of it? Like, I mean, I get they were trying to say, oh, he survived, but I mean, like, them realizing it, a TARDIS and it disappearing would have given that away anyway. Well, I don't know why his face needed to be on it. Despite all my quibbles and issues with it, I mean, it's not a bad story. It's yeah, as I say, it's my least favourite of the season, but I do still think there's a lot to enjoy in it. But for me, it was just, yeah, not as great as it could have been. And I'm really glad they went back to introducing Leela in the next story and having a companion again, because I don't think the Doctor really works as well most of the time without a companion. As an occasional one-off, it's nice, but as a regular thing, it just wouldn't work for me.
Oh, I totally prefer the Doctor with a companion, and I think one reason I like this so much is because of how different it is, because of it's basically an experiment. Can the Doctor function without one? And I think the answer is, for one very unique story, yes. For everything else, no. And we've had a lot more companionless stuff or pseudo-companion-based stuff in New Who, and I don't think it's worked. Whereas I think The Deadly Assassin is a story that only works because the Doctor's on his own, because he's companionless, and it's written in quite well. You know, Sarah has to leave because the Doctor can't take her to Gallifrey, and that does sort of get hand-waved in Invasion of Time. But then the Gallifrey series kind of shows us that there is a lot of xenophobia on Gallifrey. Time Lords do think they're superior. I can even explain away the Barren Road of Technology thing with Time Lords considering Time Lord technology to be separate from technology, being advanced, being all that kind of thing. They're a very arrogant species. So I actually think it's fairly in keeping. That third episode, yeah, it's padding. No escaping that. But it's good padding. I really like it. And again, it's not something you get in any other Doctor Who story. You know, the Doctor being hunted in this surreal, weird, non-universe. I just love it. I really do think it's such a fantastic idea. You know, let's take the rules of the universe away from the Doctor and force him to survive. And he has a really rough time. He's near enough dead by the end of it. And I just think that the sort of slow descent of the Doctor's physical and mental well-being throughout the episode is actually really, really well, but really subtly done. Greg, we'll move on to you. What do you think of The Deadly Assassin?
You know, I think The Deadly Assassin, it's difficult to watch it in context now, because I can understand why it wasn't very popular when it came out, because it did things with Gallifrey that were completely like out of sorts with what little we've seen of it prior to this. But I think what makes the story work so well for me is that, like, when you see it, you know, now with all the, you know, knowledge of the future and so on, this doesn't come across as well. But when you think about it, like, it is impossible to predict where this story is going to go. Like, everything about it is brand new. Like, everything about it, whether it's a plot point or a concept or whatever, is being introduced to, like, the Doctor Who universe. And it's just, you know, we've never seen Gallifrey like this. I mean, we've never seen the Matrix before. Like, we've only ever seen the Master as, you know, suave, suit-wearing Roger Delgado, and not this crazed maniac who's, you know, moments from death at any given time. Like, it's, we, you know, because we've not had a story with no companions in it. I mean, we've, you know, Mission to the Unknown is obviously its own thing, but that doesn't even have the Doctor. I mean, this is the only time we see a full story with the Doctor being companionless. And so that introduces, you know, more uncertainty and more risk into the story, because, you know that Tom Baker's still going to be around for the next episode, or the next story rather, but you don't know if anyone else is still going to be around. So, you know, you get some characters that die unexpectedly. I love the way that it starts. I love, like, the surrealistic way that the Doctor has the dream sequence of assassinating the president. Like, it's really, you know, well done in how it wrong-foots and disconcerts the audience. And I think that's great. I also, you know, part of me misses, you know, the Gallifrey of the War Games, and, you know, kind of wishes we had seen more of that, like with the Time Lords actually being these, like, godlike figures that are much elevated over the rest of the universe and who only come down and, you know, when they're absolutely needed, you know, as opposed to this, which became the standard of Gallifrey, which is how bureaucratic and, and dead the planet really is. But it makes a lot more sense to me that the Doctor would want to leave this planet as opposed to the other one, because, you know, he can say, oh, I, you know, non-interference was, you know, the thing I couldn't handle. But it seems like that other mystical Gallifrey would be a lot less boring. Whereas this one, you can see why it would, something, someone who's got the adventurous spirit like the Doctor would be like, oh my God, I have to get out of here. And I think that that makes more sense. But I mean, man, like everything about this, like, just resonates forward into the rest of the classic series, the new series. I mean, heck, even before this, we'd only ever seen Time Lords in, you know, in robes. Now they wear the headdresses, and, you know, and while Jimmy's right that they say here that that's only worn on rare occasions, it's stuck. And this just became how we see Time Lords. And even into the new series, we still see them in the headdresses. And it's a great bit of costuming. It's, you know, not surprising to me that the guy who designed those would go on to win 3 Oscars, because they're brilliantly designed. Yeah, I mean, and then the, you know, the dream sequence, the Matrix sequence, again, like, yeah, you know, they say, well, the Matrix is the repository of all Time Lord knowledge and Time Lord minds. And we don't, you don't get any of that in episode 3. I mean, there's no, like, reference to other Time Lord minds being in there. It's just this surreal world. So in that sense, yeah, I understand it's not really what they described it as, but I agree that it is padding, but it's so good. Like, it's so entertaining and so well made. And I don't mind padding when it, yeah, I said this during the Pertwee era too. Like, there were some of those action sequences that were completely pointless, but boy, were they fun to watch. And this is, you know, this is a very similar thing to that. I love the Deadly Assassin. It's one of my favorites. I think in most seasons, this would hands down be the best story, but it's in season 14, so it's not.
Just one more thing to note before we move on. Jimmy, you said you were more used to the Jeffrey Beavers version of this Master, and completely agree with you. You know, I think it's a wonderful performance. I think Beavers has got such an excellent voice, and it's well worth listening to the audiobook of the Target novelization of this series, because you get this Master's dialogue read by Beavers. And there is a video I once saw on YouTube where somebody had dubbed the Beavers version from the audiobook into the scene, and it works fantastically. It was a few years ago that I saw this, but if it's track downable, it's definitely, definitely worth seeing.
Oh, wow, that does sound good. I'll definitely have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, it was very, very well done. And it did add something. I completely agree with you there. Not to do down this Peter Pratt version. I do also think Peter Pratt has a fantastic voice. But because we know and love this version of the Master sort of definitively as Jeffrey Beavers now through Big Finish, it's definitely worth finding. Let's shift on. Let's move on to another absolutely fantastic story. The Face of Evil, which has a really, really good premise, really neat idea. It's not the first and certainly not the last The Computer's Gone Insane story that Doctor Who has done, but I think this is probably the best version of that story. It did get a bit of a... It did become a bit of a trope, I think, and has, you know, throughout the 70s, and there's even bits of it in the 60s. You know, I'm looking at you, The War Machines, great story, but it is Computer breaks its programming, goes mad type thing. But yeah, the whole idea of the Doctor landed somewhere previously, messed it up, and now has to face the consequences of that, I really like. We don't get enough of that. We don't get enough of the Doctor being held to account. Or certainly not in the classic era. You could argue that we perhaps get too much of it in more recent times, but I think it was a pretty rare thing back then. Some great performances. Leela is brilliant straight away. Really good and interesting character. It's full of witty dialogue. I'm really, really glad that Chris Boucher has arrived, because he is one of my favourite Doctor Who writers of all time. And what an excellent story to produce on your first effort. So Jimmy, Face of Evil, go ahead.
Yeah, I love this one, and I think it's pretty hugely underrated. It's, yeah, not the best of the season by any means, but it's definitely, it holds its own against these other excellent stories. Leela is such an amazing character and gets such a great introduction. I mean, before this point, most of the companions have been either present or historical, and, you know, Steve and Vicky and Sarah Kingdom, you don't really get much fleshed out detail about the future they're from, whereas here, the whole story is devoted to this planet that they're trapped on, and, you know, the Sever team, survey team, and the tech missions, and turning into these two separate tribes being manipulated by the computer. It's such a brilliant idea, and they really realise it quite well. I mean, I love they had that thing, the gestures that the Sever team made, and the Doctor's like, oh, that's the same motions as you use to check your space suit, which was a good, clever setup. But then, on the other hand, they did have that weird, huge, exaggerated bow that the Tesh do, and they didn't give a technical or cultural explanation for that, and I think that was a bit of a missed opportunity. But, yeah, for the bulk of the story, it's just this brilliant dynamic between the Doctor and Leela and establishing them together. I mean, that whole thing with their first meeting and the evil one, oh, evil's overstating it, and then the jelly babies and eating babies and so on, and even in this story where, you know, at the end, he didn't actually look like he wanted to take Leela and she had to sort of burst into the TARDIS to get there. He's already teaching her in this story as well, like that whole line about never be certain of anything. It's a sign of weakness. And, yeah, I think they just have such a great dynamic together, and Leela gets established really well because you've got this whole culture that's, you know, devoted to the gods and she doesn't believe it. And, like, I think that shows sometimes in the audios and the books and so on, Leela gets treated a bit as, oh, she's a bit stupid, she's the savage or whatever, but here it's clear she's got this natural intelligence to her. Like, she may not have all the intellectual or cultural knowledge, but she's clever and she can work out how things work. And they, even at the end of the story, when they the Sever team and the Tesh seem to be looking like they're going to make Leela the leader until she abandons them and goes with the Doctor, it's, and already she's showing the differences to a normal companion. Like, when they have Zoannon at the end, when he's turned good and been fixed, materializes the chair, and she's obviously never seen a chair like that before. She sits cross-legged on top of it. I think Leela is one of the better realized, not alien as such because she's human, but the more alien culture sort of characters. I think she just has such a great dynamic with the Doctor, and, yeah, this is the perfect start to it. I definitely, as much as I love Sarah Jane and as much as I enjoy the first half of this season, this later half is where it's at for me. I just really enjoy Leela as a character, and I think she's such a breath of fresh air at this point in the series.
Yeah, I think that Sarah Jane, when she was first introduced, was very much the sort of kick that the series needed to just move forward a little bit. You know, a very different kind of character, different to previous companions, a bit more independent. And I think when we get to Leela, and there are definitely problems with the way that Leela is presented, you know, looking at it from a 2023-24 point of view. But I think Leela is an incredibly strong character and is, again, another shot in the arm, something else that we need to move forward. Like, characterization, brilliant. Costume department, maybe less so. But I think that there's definitely a lot to love there with the character. Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, I can start there. I mean, Leela is great. You know, Louise Jameson is one of the best actors among the entire roster of companions. And you can see, like, right off the bat here, like, she's like Jimmy said, you know, she makes very interesting choices. Like, she's very aware of, you know, her character's backstory and how her character's going to react, you know, in certain situations, and it works incredibly well. Now, I mean, I know, you know, behind the scenes that, you know, she and Tom Baker did not get along during this season, but you don't see that really on screen. Like, I think they actually have a really good chemistry together. I think it's that, you know, teacher student, that, you know, Eliza Doolittle thing that comes up even more in, you know, Wang Chiang in a couple of stories. But I think, like, right off the bat, like, you can, if you go into the story with no knowledge, like, within the first episode, you're like, oh yeah, that's the new companion. Like, I mean, it's just so obvious how well it works. And the story itself is great. I mean, it's a very smart and interesting story. It's one of the ones where it takes the entire 4-episode running time and keeps like layering new information through the story as it progresses. Like it's very little padding in this. Like almost everything that happens has a reason and builds on what we've known from before. A little bit of padding at the end when they're, you know, trying to get Zoannon shut down, but you know, repetitive action sequences, but nothing, you know, severe, nothing like what we've seen in so many others. And I love the idea of, you know, this mad computer that the Doctor encountered, which really there's no gap for him to have encountered it, but we've kind of retconned it to say that, oh, it was when he was in the TARDIS briefly in the unit infirmary. Sure, but just the concept of, like, you know, the Doctor came here and, like, didn't really know what he was doing and made a mistake and, you know, changed history, and now it's his face that's on the mountain and his personality that's in the computer. And it's just a great idea. And yeah, the whole concept of, you know, these two tribal societies being long descendants of, you know, the colonists that, you know, have completely lost their original history and have built their own new mythology around what little they can remember. Like, that's such a neat idea. I mean, Chris Boucher is one of the best writers of classic Who, and you can really see why in this story, but like it's really good. I mean, this is yet another one that would be the best story in most respective seasons, but not this one. But yeah, it's great. I love it.
I've always liked to think that there's a really big gap for the Doctor between Deadly Assassin in the Face of Evil and the previous story happened there. And I know, well, you know, we know it's a gap that Big Finish have sort of taken advantage of. There was the whole solo series in there and some other no companion stuff that feasibly would only fit at that point. So yeah, I'm thinking that actually chronologically the first story, the first encounter with Zoannon happens between Deadly Assassin and Face of Evil, but there's a pretty big gap there. But that's just continuity wrangling, which we have to do a lot of, I guess. You're quite right, though. It's perhaps underrated, underappreciated, but I think it's because it's just surrounded by so many big hitters. And we're moving on to a story now that objectively could actually be the best story of the classic era when you sort of take that step back and take the whole favourite story concept out of it. The Robots of Death is just brilliantly executed. It's so well pieced together. It looks incredible. Like they picked a very different, unique style and went with it. There is some excellent world building here. You know, there's, like Gallifrey, this has sort of spun off numerous series, actually. You know, Kaldor has been explored in different ways by different people and incredibly well, incredibly differently. But I really like every single direction it's taken. It's still a place I want to know more about. It's still a society I want to know more about, despite the fact that there is a Kaldor audio series and there's the robots from Big Finish, plus there's books, plus there's tenuous, perhaps fan-created Blake Seven links. It genuinely is a fantastic amount fit into that 90 minutes, into that 4 parts, and it's also a very, very thrilling, interesting, rip-roaring, philosophical story. There is a hell of a lot to love about Robots of Death, so Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, as you say, it's definitely a great job setting up this whole world and this future setting, and the crew of the Sandminer all have their own personalities. There's, yeah, just such an excellent job of establishing this setting, and of course it's Leela's first trip in the TARDIS, and they do some great stuff with that at the start, like with her thinking the Yo-Yo is powering the TARDIS, and you know, straight away, yes, I know it's not magic, when the Doctor corrects her. And yeah, also the explanation of the TARDIS outside fitting the inside, and the whole, oh well, if you could keep the box this size but put it that far away at the same time, and yeah, the way Leela's like, that's a ridiculous explanation, and the Doctor's like, no, it's key discovery of the Time Lords. It's, yeah, such a great opening this story has, and Leela is just, once again, brilliant. Like, she straight away is so competent, despite she obviously is not going to understand much in this future setting, but she's, you know, she notices something's wrong with the ship before it crashes, and the doctor dismisses her so bluntly, but she's not wrong. It does happen. And same thing again when Tuce gets injured, and she has that line about, you know, we say in our tribe to look for a man with scars. And, you know, she may not be the most intelligent companion in terms of, you know, general knowledge or whatever, but she's clearly not stupid. And that's something I think that, as much as I love Big Finish, they often do get wrong with her. They do play her a bit too dumb in places, but she's really competent and clever in her own way. And I think that really shows in this season in particular. And I love the line the doctor gets, I forget to which character, about the inverse ratio between the size of the mouth and the size of the brain. It's just such a brilliant insult. I absolutely love it. And another thing I've got to speak about is, of course, D84 is such a great character. So well written, and he plays the part so well. And when he gets disappointed and upset that he's failed, and the doctor gives him that nice little speech about failing being a step in being human or something, it's just such a lovely line. And then, of course, the ending, the way they handle Capel going out, it's just so perfectly fit to the story. Just he's all about how he thinks he's a robot and he thinks he's the same as them, and ultimately he dies because he's not. They don't recognize him once his voice changes, and kill all humans, and he is ultimately human despite what he thinks. It's, almost poetic ending. It's really well done. And the one other thing I've got to say is, just, of course, coming to this later and, you know, having all the audios and having all these other stories, it's a little bit amusing when SV7 tells Tuce about countermeasures being taken, because, of course, she goes on to play Rachel Jensen, and in the countermeasures audios, I just couldn't help but get a little chuckle out of that. But, yeah, excellent story. Absolutely love it. And the Leela and Fourth Doctor dynamic is just, yeah, so brilliantly established right from the start in this season.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that this is a story that uses Leela's background, Leela's character, to its advantage. You know, the fact that she's very good at reading people and obviously can't read the robots and all that kind of thing. It's really, really well played. You can tell that this is a story written by the person that created the character, and it's done exceptionally well. Greg, go ahead.
One scene I always like to draw attention to is right at the beginning. It's when they're still in the TARDIS, and the doctor explains to Leela how the TARDIS can be bigger on the inside than the outside. And, you know, and just using the two boxes and, you know, just the idea of perspective. And then if you could keep that box over there and have it over here, then this one would fit inside it. Like, it's nonsense, and Leela's immediately realizes, like, that doesn't make any sense. But, like, I think that so perfectly encapsulates, like, the meeting between science fiction and fantasy that, you know, defines so much of Doctor Who, is that, like, it, because the Doctor is not being tongue-in-cheek. Like, he's trying to explain it to her the best he can when he knows it's just an inherently ridiculous concept. And I love that moment. It's one of the best individual scenes in the entirety of Doctor Who for me. It works so well. And then that leads into maybe the best classic Doctor Who story of all time. I mean, like you said, the production design here is just unbelievable how good it looks. Like, the decision, you know, to do these like Art Deco robots and to have them just have like frozen expressionless faces and just, just voices, works so well, because now you don't need to worry about, oh, that looks kind of, you know, lousy because you can see the mouth moving or whatever. Like, yeah, no, they're just these expressionless things. And that also enables them to be like these, you know, it almost looks like a friendly expression on their face. And they're like these friendly and helpful servants until the eyes turn red and they become murderers. And then it's like this frightening, impassive look. Like, it's such good design. The sets look amazing. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. Like, you can, the season 14 is the best, like, budget wise that the show ever got. I mean, you can just see the money in every episode, and you can also see why season 15 doesn't look nearly as good because they said, okay, enough of this, like you're spending too much on Doctor Who, but man, does it look good. And honestly, you know, the plot is so tightly structured. Like, I love, you know, little things like the Doctor pretty much knows from minute one that the robots are the ones doing the killing, but he also knows he can't just throw that out there right away. So he just kind of like hints at it because he knows no one will believe him. Like, you know, just smart little things like that. Like the complexity of the plot, like slowly builds, but it never gets too, you know, obscure. Like it works really well. And man, that acting in this, I mean, of course, Tom Baker and Louise Jameson are great, but like, you know, you've got Pamela Salem and David Bailey and David Collins and Russell Hunter. I mean, it's one of the best casts that a classic Doctor Who story ever had. And it works. Like, the performances are so good. The characterization is so good. Like, each of these feels like individual, unique people. The world building is so good. Like, you learn so much about the society, even though you spend the entire story locked in just one vehicle. I don't know. I can keep talking about this for an hour if you want, but I don't think you want that. So I'll just stop it there. But man, it's good. It's so good. I love it. Everyone should watch it. It's the best.
I mean, I'd be happy for you to talk about it for an hour, to be honest, because there is so much to be said about it. It's just absolutely brilliant. It's such a good story. And, you know, the robots themselves, absolutely fantastic sort of villain. Really, really creepy. And there's, you know, one of the themes of the story is, oh, aren't robots creepy? And it's worked in really effectively. We'll move on to... I mean, it's one hell of a story, isn't it? We'll move on to Talons of Wang Chiang, which is another one that hits it out of the park. And obviously, let's get the it's problematic in 2024 bit out of the way, because it is. There's no way around this. It was pretty dodgy even at the time, I think it's fair to say. But what's good is good. It's very good. It's an excellent story. It's a brilliantly... played story. It's, again, Tom Baker and Louise Jameson are just sublimely brilliant. It has its one ratty flaw, visually, I guess, but otherwise there's a very, very strong story in there. And it's got another absolutely fantastic Robert Holmes double act. You know, I didn't really mention Spandrel and Engin. They're brilliant and deserve their own spin-off series, but here we have Jago and Lightfoot, who are beyond brilliant and do have their own spin-off series, two characters that are just instantly likable. And when they eventually pair up, which happens very late in the story, but when they eventually pair up, it's just gold. It's brilliant. Really excellent story, really great villain. Again, some wonderful, not so much world buildings. It's set in Victorian London, but I like the stuff about the 51st century, and this is the first reference to time agents in Doctor Who, and we know that other writers have run with that. And it's probably more influential on sort of Doctor Who continuity than it's given credit for, actually. But it's also a wonderful standalone piece, a great six episodes, and made by a production team that knew it was outgoing, didn't really care anymore, so well overspent on it, and, you know, visually absolutely worth it, I'd say. So let's do the final story of the season. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, I really love this one. I think, as you say, definitely problematic in terms of the racist side of things. But I think a lot of that is probably because it's set in the 1800s. And so even though it's written in the 1970s, some of it might be, in fairness to them, trying to accurately portray, you know, how much more racist and terrible the 1800s were. The problem with it is when it's four, because, you know, Leela obviously doesn't understand and doesn't have that culture, so she doesn't realise what she's saying bad. And the 1800s characters, you know, it's their world. But the parts where the Doctor occasionally says something and it's like, ooh, pretty bad. But, yeah, for me, I can – obviously it's easier for us as, you know, white people to look past that and, you know, but I obviously understand why other fans can't. But for me, the thing that makes the story is, of course, once again, the Doctor and Leela's dynamic together, and also, of course, Jago and Lightfoot and their dynamic together in the lead up to you know, obviously not intended as lead up, but for their series that they eventually got on the audios, I think they, yeah, though between those four characters, the dynamic is so good. And I love the Fourth Doctor and Leela's initial Victorian costumes. It's nice that Leela got to actually be dressed a bit more normally for it. And Tom's wonderful Sherlock Holmes-esque costume is just brilliant. But yeah, for me, Dagon and Lightfoot are just the absolute highlights. They get introduced so well, so brilliantly acted. And not just their dynamic with each other, but also particularly with Lightfoot and Leela when she's at his house and he's trying to get her to eat normally, and she picks up the whole chunk of meat to eat, and he gets the plate, and she sort of looks at him, and he just puts it down, and he sort of gets this sweet look on his face, like, oh, all humour, and he's eating it, and it's just so sweet. And then the way he tries to explain things to her, like when he teaches her about napkins, or at the end of the story when he's telling her how to have tea with one sugar, and she doesn't understand why you've only have one. It's just brilliant that, you know, this Victorian posh character gets to be a bit down to earth and tries to explain things to Leela, and it's just such a sweet dynamic between them. I really loved that. But for me, the thing that is a bit odd about the story that sort of didn't work too well is I love the whole, you know, time agent thing, and that sets up, you know, Captain Jack in the new series and so much stuff in the extended universe, but it doesn't quite make sense because Greel's talking about how he's used the Sigma experiments in the cabinet to get back in time, and how the successful experiments in time travel, but if he thinks he's the first time traveler, then why does he know about time agents in the first place and seem unsurprised by the idea that they've followed him? Like, it just, yeah, I mean, I love that it ended up being such a huge thing in the new series and they built it up so well, but it doesn't really make sense in the context of the story. I think it's almost a pity that, I forget where I read it or heard it, but apparently they were originally considering having the Master again for this story and it being him, not Greel. And, I mean, it would have been a shame to lose some of the stuff we did get, but I think it possibly would have worked better for the story, so it's almost unfortunate that it didn't happen. But, yeah, overall, great story, very atmospheric. It's just a shame about the stuff that, for obvious reasons, has been pretty dated and, as you say, not even right at the time, but at least more understandable at the time, hopefully. It's a shame that a story that's so good in so many respects has so much stuff that isn't, on the other hand. And, yeah, it's a pity. It does sort of detract from an otherwise brilliant story.
I'm going to fan make up that time agents had travelled back from the end of the 51st century to the start of it, which is where Greel was doing his experiments. That ties that one up with a not so neat bow, hopefully. But yeah, I totally see your point. Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just to, you know, touch on the uncomfortable parts of the story, like, I, you know, it's a shame because, like, you know, unfortunately, like, the supporting Chinese characters are all, like, portrayed as being in, you know, gangs or opium trade or whatever, and that's obviously not great. But then when you actually have, like, the character of Lee Sen Chang, who is, like, a great character, a layered character, like, someone who, like, encounters, you know, persistent racism of the time, and someone who's, you know, very aware of, like, you know, where he belongs and where he doesn't as a Chinese man in Victorian London, like, then you put a white guy in awful yellow face to play it. Like, it's just like, oh, like, just cast a Chinese actor to play the part. Like, you've got Chinese actors to play the other characters. I don't know. But you know, you need to, you know, put that aside when discussing the story, because otherwise it's going to just dominate the whole conversation. So, you know, just that's bad. It should never have been done. And that's a shame, because it's otherwise just an absolute brilliant Doctor Who story. Like, it's again, it's so good. Like, if it wasn't for the robots of death, this would be the best story of the season. It would be the best story in most seasons. You know, it's an example of a six-part story that never really feels padded out, because it smartly changes the villain over time. Like, the first half of the story, really up through most of the first four episodes, it's mostly Chang that they're investigating, and then slowly, you know, he gets phased out of the story and gets replaced by Greel, and that leads to a very exciting, you know, last two episodes. I love Michael Spice as Greel. Like, he's very much in the, you know, Stephen Thorne or Gabriel Wolfe vein of, you know, someone playing a villain who you can't really see their face at all. And he's just doing the entire performance by movement and voice. And I mean, he's wildly over the top, but that's okay because it works so well. Like, this is very much like presented as, you know, a pulp serial kind of thing. And, you know, you expect like heightened performances and things like that. And I mean, he goes after every single piece of the scenery is chewed when he's on screen, and it works really well. And Tom Baker just is having an absolute blast, like acting opposite that in episode six. And that's great. I mean, Leela's great here, like introducing a character who's simultaneously a savage and someone who's from the future into, you know, such a mannered society, and just her constant presence just puncturing and undercutting all the self-seriousness of the Victorian era. Like, it's an interesting sort of modern, you know, bit of characterization that I like. And yeah, I mean, we talk about Jago and Lightfoot, and of course, I mean, they're wonderful, and of course they are able to support 13 plus series of spin-off material from Big Finish, because I mean, these are two of the best supporting characters the show ever had. And you can tell because they get their own scenes. Like, the Doctor and Leela are off doing, you know, whatever they're doing. And like, and then we go and see what Jago is up to. And then we go and see what Lightfoot is up to. Like, and then eventually, you know, they're brought together, but like, there's four protagonists in this story, and there are two of them. And by the time they team up, like, it just feels right. And like, now that, of course, I've experienced, you know, all of the spinoff material, like, it's so delightful just to see, you know, them meeting once more. But like, man, like, I can see why they thought about doing a spinoff with them at the time, because it's magical. Like, it really is. I apart from the obvious that I talked about before, like, there's really nothing to complain about here. Yet again, everything looks great except the rat. But, you know, ridiculous monsters in Doctor Who are not a new thing. Like, I don't know why people play that up as such a problem. It looks ridiculous, but fine, whatever. And the last thing, you know, what I like about this too is, what I like about Leela in this story is that even though, you know, she's, you know, from this, you know, this tribe where she's a warrior and she's, you know, very brave and she's ready to, you know, cut out someone's heart, like, she's not a violent, you know, robot. Like, I think some of the audio portrayals of Leela in this era, like Jimmy said, either portray her as stupid or portray her as just this single-minded killer. Whereas, you know, in stories like this, you see that, yeah, she's incredibly brave, but she's young, and she's also aware of her own mortality. Like, right at the beginning, when she's surrounded by like 10 guys, you know, with weapons, like, she knows she's not going to win that fight. You can see on her face that she's scared for her life. Like, that, I feel like sometimes we want to see Leela as this just constantly, like, nothing scares her, nothing intimidates her. But I think in the actual TV show, that's not always the case. And I think you see that here. And yet she's never portrayed as, you know, the screaming damsel in distress. I mean, yeah, she's screaming when the rat is trying to eat her, but I think most people would scream in that situation. And otherwise, yeah, I mean, she's brave, but you can see like layers to it. And I think that's just a little detail that really works for me. But yeah, apart from the obvious problems, Talons of Wang Chiang is an excellent Doctor Who story.
It's such a shame that it is as flawed as it is, because I think it would be a very, very good story to introduce somebody to classic Doctor Who for the first time, you know, after seeing new stuff maybe. But it's way too flawed. There are way too many problems there. But yeah, if you dig beneath that, then there is a really, really, really incredibly good story there. One thing I've always said about it as well, and while I completely believe that the yellow face just shouldn't have happened, I think it was a bad idea at the time. I think that that kind of thing was woefully outdated in the mid-70s. John Bennett's performance is excellent. He takes it seriously. He's not playing up. He doesn't camp it up. He doesn't fall into some very, very dodgy stereotypes that other performers that did similar things did. It's a really, really good, really, really strong performance. It's just that the whole concept of that character being played by that actor is wrong. It's that simple. It's just wrong. Yeah, it's such a shame that there are just a few too many, shall we say, poorly judged decisions that went into the production of the story, because there's some absolutely wonderful stuff in there as well. It's a really, really strong, really good Doctor Who story, as you said, Greg. So that's been season 14. It's a great season. There's no taking away from that. It's perhaps, you know, objectively, take that step back, it's arguably the strongest. I said the same about season 13, but I think 13 and 14 are arguably the strongest series of Classic Who there are. Not my favourite. My favourite is yet to come. But it's just what a run of stories, what a collection of stories. And,
I put this above season 13 because it doesn't have Planet of Evil.
Yes, it's a distinct advantage. we've talked about some absolutely great stuff in the last few episodes of this that we've done, and it's kind of a shame that we're not going to have that as much praise to heap onto season 15. I think there's some great stuff in there. You know, I always thoroughly loved The Invasion of Time, despite its numerous obvious flaws. It's still great fun. But it's... There's a sense of, you know, now we've done this episode, it's not going to be quite this good again. There's some amazing stuff to come still. There's some wonderful Doctor Who to come still. But I think that in terms of in production, in visuals, in chemistry between the leads, in just all this kind of thing, writing even, you know, we lose Robert Holmes as script editor midway through the next season. I just don't think we get there again. I think we are sort of closing the book on a bit of a golden age here, which is a shame. But like I say, there's still a hell of a lot to look forward to as we continue these season by season episodes. So roll on 15. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation when we get there. But that is all we have time for now. So I will say a huge thank you and goodbye to Jimmy.
Thanks. It's been great.
And a huge thank you and goodbye to Greg.
We'll see you next time.
And we'll be back for more Spodcasting very soon. Goodbye now.